Okay, so Ketanim in Kriyat HaTorah, can a minor get an aliyah? Now, this is a simple question because the Gemara addresses it explicitly. The Gemara says yes, right? After the discussion, we just had to get through the Gemara about the number of different aliyahs and some of the symbolism there. But jumping to the end of the Gemara that we saw, the Gemara quotes a braita, Kol olin l'minyan shiva. Everyone goes up or counts to the count of seven readers for Kriyat HaTorah. Va'afilu katan, even a minor, va'afilu isha, even a woman. And the Gemara goes on to say that there's a secondary gzeira that says a woman really should not get aliyahs. We're going to save that for 2 weeks from now. Rabbi Weiss and the Kola will deal with this. So we'll focus mostly on Ketanim. There were discussions, but one topic at a time. They really are actually quite different topics. So Ketanim means short people. If you can't see over the bima, even then you can get an aliyah. But also the Gemara says pretty simply that a katan should be able to get an aliyah, and that seems to be the basic understanding of the story. The Rif paskens that way. I didn't show you the Rif, but you saw the Rambam in Hilchot Tefillah. The Rambam says this halacha with no qualification. A katan is able to get an aliyah. The one qualification is that he needs to know who he's making a bracha to when he makes the bracha, right? So there's a minimum standard below which. You know, you're not really considered let's say, a bar dot. You don't really have enough mental faculties to be useful for an aliyah. But once you have those mental faculties, you're able to get an aliyah. And the poskim discusses that 6 years old or 7 years old, is it variable? Does it depend on the kid? There's a whole literature just about that point.
A general question. When you're talking about katan, it means boy and girl, or just boy?
So for our purposes, we're going to focus on boys, but it seems like it should be boys and girls, because if you're going to include both a katan and a woman, so it should follow that a woman who's a katan or a katana should also be included. I think that would be the baseline assumption. But because we're going to try to avoid the gendered issues for this week, we're going to focus on male katanim. Because, you know, a katana is going to be the intersection of every, you know, concern that we have about katanim and every concern we have about isha. So just the overlap of those two issues.
I'm just wondering if there's an analogy, not exactly in the session, in the situation, but it's almost like a sveik sveik.
I think you layer on the concerns. Yeah, you can imagine someone saying that. I haven't seen anyone who puts that on the record. So,
Not if they're married.
I mean, I think most of the Rishonim, as far as I know, most of them have kids. Okay, so that's the baseline assumption of the Gemara. Now, anyone who pushes back a little bit on Ketanim, so you have plenty of sources to rely on in pushing back. So, for example, you saw the Ran. The Ran quotes a couple of limitations. First of all, you might want to limit it to a minority of aliyahs, right? Meaning, sorry, you're thinking of the Rambam, the source
Later.
number four. No, so the Ran is source number two. The Ran says you can't be all ketanim and nashim. You have to have at least, it sounds from the Ran like you have to have at least one adult male. Others understand the Ran to be referring to a majority. I'm not sure I see that in the Ran himself, but others quote the Ran to say that you need a majority of adult men. But you can have up to three women or children in the mix. But you can't have all women. That's restriction number one that the Ran puts forward. We'll talk about why that might be in a bit. Then he also throws in another restriction. He says that back in the times when you only had the brachot of Kriyat HaTorah on the first aliyah and the last aliyah, so an Isha or a Katan could not take one of those aliyahs, because the assumption of the Ran is that you need the katan to say the bracha and be motzi everyone else in that bracha, and the katan's incapable of doing that, and so he can't get those aliyahs. But nowadays, when we make a bracha before and after each and every aliyah, the Ran says you're going to be okay for a katan to take each and every aliyah, because that's the nature of the takana. Once you make a takana that allows you to make a bracha each and every time, even though in theory there should be a bracha chain of shricha, it should be an unnecessary bracha, but once we make a takana that allows you to do it, we let everyone do it for each aliyah, even Nashim and Ketanim. The Meiri says very similarly. The Meiri also quotes that first restriction that maybe you need at least a minimum of one adult male, and the rest could be Ketanim, but you can't have one. You can't have all women and children. And the reason the Meiri gives is very interesting. We'll circle back to this in a moment. He says the Takanat Moshe, the original Takanat of Kriyas the Torah from the time of Moshe, was only to do a reading, and that Takanat requires that you have an adult male. Then the secondary takana, what we call Takanat Ezra, doesn't require an adult male. It could be even a woman or ketanim. But in order to fulfill that first takana, you need an adult. We'll have to explain why that is in a little bit. We saw the Turin Megillah give an explanation. And there's one more, you know, set of restrictions. Oh, I should mention also that the Meiri, interestingly, goes the opposite direction of the Ran with regard to the bracha. I mean, the Ran says that nowadays, once we make a bracha for each aliyah, we no longer need the children to make a bracha to be motzi someone else. And so any aliyah could be taken by kata. The Meiri goes the other direction. The Meiri says, once we make a bracha each and every aliyah, so every aliyah is a vocation to make a bracha that you don't need to make. He says, for example, a woman doesn't make a bracha haTorah. The assumption is, which is an interesting assumption in and of itself, but since a woman's not obligated in Kriyas haTorah, she shouldn't make a bracha in Kriyas haTorah. And if you need to make a bracha in order to get an aliyah, and you can't make a bracha because you're not obligated, so you're excluded from getting an aliyah. That's the Meiri's claim about the bracha. That relates a little bit to a discussion that I think you did with Rabbi Spurn about the nature of the brachas haTorah that we make on Kriyas haTorah. Is that a typical bracha haMitzvah that would then be subject to the, you know, well-known debate about whether women make a bracha on fulfilling mitzvah they're not obligated in? Or maybe it's a new kind of bracha specifically established for Kriyas haTorah, and maybe the rules would be different for that bracha. So we're not going to rehash that whole conversation, but I should allude to that fact because it comes up in these Rishonim. But for our purposes, the more important restrictions are the restrictions about the numbers that you're allowed to have. So the Ran and the Meiri both seem to say that you need at least one Jewish adult male. And the Rambam quotes a view from the Gaonim that actually the first three aliyahs of any Kriyas haTorah need to be adult males, and only 4 through 7 can be minors. So that's an interesting view, right? The Rambam, you know, besides being the simple reading of the Gemara and the one the Rif adopts and other Rishonim adopt, who says that a katan can be any aliyah, seems to be the simplest view. Either a katan is good or a katan is bad, right? You don't have to add qualification. So we have to figure out what's motivating all of these restrictions. Why should we say that the first three can't be counted, but the rest can? What distinction is there between the first three and the other four? Why do we would we need one specific adult male somewhere in the seven? Right? If a cotton counts, he should count. And if he doesn't count, he shouldn't count. But this halfway house is a little bit strange. So we're going to circle back to that. We have to, before we do though, let's go back to the Rambam. We'll try to explain the Rambam first, and then the other Rishonim second. So the Rambam, you know, is very simple, very clean, a katan count. But he seems, or he should, run afoul of a Mishnah, which articulates a very basic halachic principle, which is that in order to be motzi someone their obligation, they need to themselves be obligated. This leads to halachic quandaries in all sorts of areas.
This is
a general principle, right? The Mishnah on Rosh Hashanah puts a principle, zahak, shlal. If you're not obligated, you can't fulfill obligations for other people. So this leads to questions about who could be motzi who in the Megillah reading. You have to be obligated in Megillah. It leads to questions about Kiddush. Can you be motzi someone else in Kiddush if you're not obligated in Kiddush? Or if you already fulfilled your obligation in Kiddush? And so on and so forth. There are many, many halachas that depend on being able to be motzi other people, which we analyze by paying attention to whether they themselves are obligated. But that seems to be a major problem for Kriyas haTorah, right? A katan, we're going to struggle to figure out why they should be obligated in Kriyas haTorah. They're a minor. They're not really obligated in anything. So how could a katan, who's not obligated in Kriyas haTorah, fulfill Kriyas haTorah for everyone else?
But like you said, everybody's making their own bracha now. Not like you.
Ah, so that might work for the aliyah. But what about everyone else in the tzibur who's here in Kriyas haTorah through the katan?
Okay.
Right? Think about it. The Megillah, right? We wouldn't let a katan read the Megillah for the tzibur. You usually have a gadol do that. Because you're fulfilling the mitzvah for everyone else and you need to be yourself obligated in order to do that. So how could we explain why Kriyas haTorah maybe is an exception to the rule? How can we explain that a katan is going to be allowed to do Kriyas haTorah for everyone? So I think there are three possible ways to go about this. The first is to try to explain how really everyone actually is obligated, right? The question is predicated on the fact that Nashim and Ketanim are not obligated in Kriyas haTorah, and how could they be mostly everyone else? Actually, we could try to argue that they are obligated in Kriyas haTorah. That's going to be a little bit more persuasive when it comes to Nashim than it will for Ketanim, because the way we think about a Katan generally is as someone who is totally removed from the parsha of obligation. And by women, we have at least some sources that seem to take the idea of being obligated in Torah reading very seriously. The Breita Masechet Sofrim seems to quote that idea. seems to assume that women are going to be obligated in Torah reading, and that's why it's important to make sure to project the Torah reading and to explain it and to translate it well enough so that everyone's able to understand it. The Braita also sounds like it's talking about children as well. It says, Nashim en tinokot. You should make sure to read and project and explain, because really they're all on some level obligated, or at least to whatever extent anyone is obligated, Nashim en tinokot are obligated as well. And the Magen Avraham, one of the major achronim on the Shulchan Aruch, a major source of contemporary halakha, quotes this Mitachas Ofrim, and he seems to take it very seriously, that women actually should be obligated to create the Torah. Then he notes at the end that, well, the minhag seems to be that women leave shul during Kriyas HaTorah. So,
at that time, that was their minhag.
That's what the Magen Avraham quotes. He says, the Mitachas Ofrim sounds like women are obligated. He says, at the end, but actually, in our time, we see that women, you know, more often than not leave shul for Kriyas HaTorah. So, I don't know that that's the major minhag. I think more often than not, you have men leaving for Kiddush Club at shul. But, you know, leave your Orthodox sociology for, you know, after the Chabura. But it's interesting. So we could take that tack and say, really, women are obligated, so they can be mochi other people. Maybe even Ketanim are obligated based on the formulation of Masechet Soferim, where it keeps linking up Nashim and Tinokot and kind of looping them all into the realm of obligation. Again, it's not so simple to say that Ketanim is going to be obligated in anything, but maybe to whatever extent anyone's obligated, Ketanim are obligated too. A paradigm for this might be the mitzvah of Hakel, the mitzvah of every 7 years to go to the Beis Hamikdash to hear the Torah read. And the Torah emphasizes that Anashim, Anashim, and Ta, right? Men, women, and children are all going to be included. And there, the Gemara goes back, you know, deals with this and says, no, but really, Ta might not actually be obligated. It's really more of a mitzvah on the adults to bring the children. So it's going to be a little bit difficult to say, but that might be one avenue to look. Maybe kids are really obligated. Avenue number two is the view of Tosfos. The source number eight, Tosfos Rosh Hashanah, write out a pretty big exception to this principle. Right? The principle in the Gemara Rosh Hashanah is that if you're not obligated, you can't be mostly other people. And Tosfos says that's true for biblical obligations, but it's not true for rabbinic obligations. If something is just a rishus, just a, you know, an option, something you could choose to do, if something's only a rabbinic obligation, then even if you're not really obligated and you're just choosing to opt in, still, you couldn't be mostly other people's obligation. And he gives the example of a katan. A katan could lead benching for their father, according to the Gemara Brachos. A katan could count for Kriyat HaTorah. A katan, according to one view in the Gemara Megillah, could read Megillah for other people. All of those are areas of rabbinic obligations that a kid really fundamentally is not obligated in. And yet, we say that a kid can be mostly them. So it could be that's going to be our answer. Kriyat HaTorah is a rabbinic obligation. If Kriyat HaTorah is only a rabbinic obligation, you don't really need to worry about whether you're being motzi other people or not. We assume Kriyas HaTorah is a rabbinic obligation. That's not going to be so difficult, but assuming that we paskin like Tosfos is a little bit difficult. Right? That seems to be a pretty big carve-out to this zahakval, this general principle. And in general, in halakha, we don't like to say this, that rabbinic obligations, we don't care about whether you're obligated or not in terms of being motzi other people.
Is Kriyat HaTorah rabbinical or Torah-based obligation?
So it seems to be a rabbinical obligation. So I think that that's a topic we have coming up as to whether, you know, the nature and the structure of the obligation to listen to Kriyas HaTorah. Is there an obligation on individuals, an obligation on the community, an obligation here? So in terms of where it came from, so the whole institution of Kriyas HaTorah is rabbinic, right? We saw that it originates with a takana made by Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, but it's an independent takana. Isn't that biblical? And then Ezra adds to it, and it's also going to be rabbinic. So we assume the Kriyas HaTorah is generally a rabbinic kind of obligation. So there might be some areas where it may have more biblical valence. I mean, the most well-known example is Parshas Zachor, but maybe there are others as well where there's more, you know, biblical kiyumim going on. So saying we follow Tosfos is a little bit difficult, but that's a possibility as well. The third possibility is a possibility, I would say it's of the Rav, but really the Rishonim already say it. And there are several Rishonim who go on the record like this. The Rosh, you saw, the Rimi Lunil, the Bach quotes this idea, others quote this idea, that we're misunderstanding the nature of Kriyas HaTorah entirely. The question is predicated on the idea that the way Kriyas HaTorah works is that one person reads and fulfills the obligation for everyone else. They are motzi then their chiyuv. So think of the way you hear one person read the Megillah. Really, you could read the Megillah for yourself. But having one person read and everyone listens, they fulfill the obligation. That's a principle that we learned about earlier this year called Shomea Ka'one. Listening is responding. And so the premise of the question is that that's how Kriyas HaTorah works. But in fact, we could deny that premise entirely. And these Rishonim all say, you know, most of the Rishonim have a formulation along the lines of Kriyat Torah is Shemiya L'tzibur or Hashma'a L'tzibur. It's not a mitzvah that everyone individually in the community is meant to do for themselves, and we just appoint one person to do that on our behalf. But the mitzvah is to teach Torah publicly to the community, to allow the community to hear the Torah reading. Well, if that's really the nature of the mitzvah, not about being motzi anybody else, but just about teaching Torah communally, so it shouldn't really matter if it's a katan or a gadol, because he's not being motzi anybody. He's just a megaphone to project Divrei Torah to the community. So you have the formulation of the Rush in source 11, in source 9, the Rimi Limel in source 10. The Rush is something very similar. He uses the phrase not of Shmia, but rather of the Tzibor being mishtateh to the public Talmud Torah. But the same basic idea. The idea is that it's an institution of teaching Torah that the community does together, but a katan is perfectly capable of learning or teaching Torah. And if they learn or teach Torah, that Torah is considered what we'd call a chafstesh Torah. You know, it's not any less of a piece of Torah, but just because the katan said it. Katan has a relationship to Torah as well. And so when he teaches it publicly, it becomes a piece of Torah, and we all join together to listen to that piece of Torah, and that is fulfilling the obligation. Right? And he draws his parallel. I think you saw this passage on a previous week. You know, imagine giving a shiur, and the Rav says, I want to be motzi you in Talmud Torah, not you in Talmud Torah. So that's absurd, right? It's not like I'm learning Torah and you're being yotzei through my learning. You're learning Torah right now. I can't prevent you from doing that just by intending to prevent you from doing that. It's a very, very difficult idea to say in an individual shir. And the Rav says the theme is true in a public shir, so to speak, which is basically what Kriyat Torah is, a public Talmud Torah barabbim. So this idea that Kriyat Torah is fundamentally about projecting Torah and teaching Torah publicly and not a normal instance of an individual recitation that one person is doing on behalf of everybody has other ramifications. Rav Schachter quotes from Rav Leibel Grusnitz, a guy in London, who asked a question about a chirish who could speak but he couldn't hear, whether he was good for Kriyas Torah. And the Rav said, of course. And Rav Schachter said, well, what's the logic there? Because I don't care whether this chirish is or is not obligated in anything. I don't care whether he's even able to hear the Torah that he's saying, because at the end of the day, he's projecting Torah to the community, and the community is hearing it. That is the mitzvah. It's not about being motzi anybody in any kind of obligation. So this is an idea from the Rav, but it really goes all the way back to many of the Rishonim as well, in slightly different formulations, but the same basic episode, which is that we're thinking about Kriyas Torah all wrong. It's really public teaching. And this is an idea we've seen in the past as well in Shulei Ka'ona and in some other kind. And that, I think, suffices to explain the Rambam. Why should a katan count? And that's really the Rav's biggest raya. Why should I cut that count? Because I don't care about obligation or not obligation. No one's being motzi anybody anything. He's just teaching Torah to the community. So that works for the Rambam. Now, what are we going to say for the other Rishonim? We have the Ran and the Meiri who say that you need at least one Gadol or maybe a majority of Gadolim. We had the view of the Gaonim that the Rambam quoted. The Beit Yosef quotes in the name of the Rokeach as well. There are a few others who say this idea. Lamaisa, the Ramah quotes it Lamaisa. That you need the first three to be gedolim and the rest don't need to be. So what's going on there? Why should we have these limitations? Right? Once a katan counts, how could we exclude a katan for some aliyah? And here I think there are two major approaches that I've seen. The first appears in the Levush, which is one of the major, early, not really sure if you should call it a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch or another sefer kind of along the same lines of the Shulchan Aruch. The Levush says it's a din in Kavod HaTorah. It's not respectful to the Torah to bring it out only to have people who are not really obligated in learning Torah and who are not, full-fledged, b'nei chiyuv, let's say, people who are obligated, read from the Torah and learn from the Torah. So if you're going to have, and this is what the Levush uses to explain why you need at least one ish, one adult male. Because you need at least some obligated person to engage with the Torah. He doesn't use the term obligated person, but he says it's a question of the honor of the Torah. And so you could probably see something very similar for requiring the first three also. You want to say, you want the baseline mitzvah to be fulfilled by people who are more mechubed to fulfill it by. And then if you're going to have non-obligated people, so that's fine as long as they're adjuncts, but not full members of the Kriyas Torah. That's one possibility.
Yeah, but the bottom line is they're still reading the Torah.
So the Levush's formulation, thanks for letting me clarify, is not about whether they should or should not read the Torah, but whether it's mechubad to take the Torah out on their behalf. Right? So there's generally a halakhic principle. We're not so, you know, I think so cognizant of this all the time, but there's a halakhic principle of the honor of the Sefer Torah. We're meant to treat the Sefer Torah with a certain amount of respect. So for example, it wouldn't be mechubad for a Sefer Torah if we're going to, you know, bring it around to, you know, individuals so that they have personal private access to private Sefer Torah. The, you know, the parameters of the halakha are very interesting, a little bit far afield for right now. But there are general principles about how we conduct ourselves in using a Sefer Torah. And it could be that we're not meant to take out a Torah only for non-obligated people to use it. It would be best to take out a Torah only for obligated, fully obligated.
Question, if I can. If it's about honor of the Torah, wouldn't the greatest honor then be no women?
Wouldn't the greatest honor be excluding women entirely because they're not obligated? You could say that, meaning once you're going to say kavod haTorah, it's very hard to know exactly where the line should be, right? So the Levush says that's why you need at least one man. Maybe that's why you should need at least three. Maybe that's why you should need all of them. It's a little bit hard, and that's why the Levush is not necessarily a satisfying explanation for us. I also am not sure that it's really the simplest reading of the Rishonim. If we go back to the Rishonim, we see formulations that seem a little bit more essential about why you should need at least one or three gedolim, right? So instead of going back to the Rishonim to see the formulations, we'll see the way the Ituri Megillah is one of the Achronim that we've used sometimes in these Shiurim to help us out. But the Ituri Megillah, for both the view that says you need one gedol and the view that says you need the first three to be gedolim, basically makes a very similar point. The basic point he tries to make is that, you know, we've forgotten, because it was many weeks ago already, that we talked about the structure of the mitzvah of Kriyas HaTorah. But actually, we should remember that this is a two-tiered mitzvah. There was an original version of Kriyas HaTorah, but Takanat Moshe, and then a secondary version of Kriyas HaTorah that was Takanat Ezra. And we talked at the time about how those are different. The Rav had his thesis that, you know, in the time of Moshe, it was about Shemiat HaTorah and exposure to Torah, and then in the time of Ezra, it became more about learning Torah and Talmud Torah. But the Torah Megillah says in a much more simple way. So he first tries to explain the view of the Gaonim, that you need the first three to be done by a Gadol. He says the first three is what we would call an individual mitzvah, a chiyuv on the yachid, a chiyuv al kol yachid v'yachid. And if that's an individual obligation, well, that's where the rules of being motzi are relevant again. So just like by Megillah, you need someone to read who could be motzi everyone else their obligation, so too for the first three aliyahs of Kriyas HaTorah, they're basically being motzi you your obligation. What about the remaining four? Those aren't really essential to Kriyas HaTorah. Those are because based on what he calls the Ma'alat Hayom, just the exalted level of the day. So three is what we call Kriyas HaTorah. Kriyas HaTorah works like every other mitzvah that someone is motzi someone else. Now, why do we read seven aliyahs on Shabbos? Because Shabbos is so kadosh. Yeah, but no one needs to be motzi anybody in that. That's not a personal individual obligation. That's about how we as a community relate to Shabbos, and we give it extra significance by adding extra aliyahs. So there, I don't care if someone's motzi anybody anything, and you could even have a katan read Kriyas HaTorah for those latter aliyahs. Similarly, for the view of the Ran and the Meiri, that you need at least one gadol, he says, same exact point. Takanas Moshe, that level of the obligation. Well, that's something that someone needs to be motzi you. That was Moshe's original takana. It's a recitation that one person is motzi everybody else. And then the remaining seven aliyahs that Ezra adds, well, those are more of a communal obligation, and you don't need to be motzi anybody in that obligation. So the structure of the answer is actually quite similar. I misspoke a drop before. I should clarify that for the Ran and the Meiri, that you need one gadol. He's drawing the distinction between Takanat Moshe and Takanat Ezra. Whereas for the view that the first three aliyahs need to be by a gadol, he's distinguishing between sort of baseline Kriyas HaTorah and Kriyas HaTorah on special days that get extra aliyahs. But in either case, he wants to make a sort of a two-tiered obligation, where ketanim are not useful for the individual obligation, they're being motzi other people, they're chiyuv, but they are useful whether for the kind of Ezra level, which is all the extra aliyahs, or the Yom Tov level, the days where you have special Kriyas HaTorah that is unique to the day, but not necessarily about being motzi anybody their obligations. And that idea, I think, is a very different idea from the Rav. Right, the Rav assumes that no element of Kriyas HaTorah is not being motzi anybody anything. These Rishonim, I think, have to disagree and say, no, you really are being motzi people in a more classical sense. Okay, so that is the structure in terms of the lumdus, in terms of the theory, the conceptual analysis. Halakha Lamaisa, what do we do? Okay. Yes, please.
I think you raised this at the very beginning, and I'm surprised No one invoked this just based on the content of the brachos themselves. There's nothing about Kriya, there's nothing about Shmi.
There's nothing about
Bachar Banu,
right?
Asher not Tanla.
Right. So that is the evidence. The Rush quotes that. The Rush explains these brachot, they're not brachot a mitzvah. Right? So of course, you know, don't say you have to be obligated to say these brachot. Right? So even according to those views that require that you be obligated in order to say a bracha, which Ashkenazim don't paskan, like Ashkenazim assume that if a woman opts into a mitzvah she's not obligated in, she does make a bracha. But this was a very live debate in the time of the Rishonim. So even according to those views, still you'd be able to say these brachas, because these really aren't brachot on the mitzvah in the strict sense. They're a unique kind of bracha. So, and I mentioned, I think, at the beginning that the Meiri says, because of these brachas, a woman, you know, she can't make the brachas, and she needs to make the brachas in order to get an aliyah, and therefore she's categorically excluded. But that's just, you know, the one view and doesn't get to the same like core question. Also, we're talking about Katana Menat Isha, so maybe that'll come up again in a couple weeks. I'll leave it to Rabbi Weiss. Okay, halakha lamais. So the Shulchan Aruch just quotes this principle from the Gemara without any qualification. It sounds like he thinks a katan is eligible for every aliyah. The Rama quotes the restriction that he quotes from the Ran and the Rivash. We saw it. The Ran and the Rivash that you need to have at least one adult male, and the Achronim, the Magen Avraham, and others quote that you need the first three to be adult men. Okay. That doesn't really explain why you don't often see Katanim getting aliyahs. So there are a couple interesting dinim that come out if you, you know, track the literature. So the Magen Avraham quotes from a tshuva of the Rivash. We didn't see it inside. It would be, you know, very far afield to like do a deep dive into that tshuva. But the Magen Avraham quotes the Rivash, who says, or who he interprets to say, that a Katanim really shouldn't get any aliyah and should only get Matir. I don't really know how to read the Breita. The Breita says they're all aluminium jibba. Right? They seem to count to the count, so it's very hard to say that a katan shouldn't get it, unless you want to appeal to some extrinsic factor. There's some, you know, reason why, you know, we shouldn't, even though the Breita says very clearly that it's allowed, there's some extrinsic reason that maybe we shouldn't do it. That's what you probably have to say for the Magen Avraham. And the Mishnah Berurah, of course, that idea. The Aruch HaShulchan was a little bit troubled by it. He says, I don't really understand. You misread the tshuva that you're talking about. But he says, at the end of the day, our custom is not to call up katanim. Except for maftir, which you sometimes do. Even then, that will only be true for maftirs that are also rabbinic, but, you know, it's a whole live debate about calling up a katan for parshat zachor, which is a biblical obligation, so even there it's a little bit trickier. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, you know, fundamentally you should be able to call up a katan. Our minhag is not to. My understanding is that there are varying minhagim among Sephardi communities, that some Sephardi communities will be more permissive with katanim, some will be less. But there's a range of views among those communities as well. But Ashkenazim, I think for the most part, don't call up Katanim for anything but Maftir. Aruch HaShulchan also quotes a view from the Arizal, the Kabbalistic view, that you, even if you could call up a Katanim for one of the first seven aliyahs, it would only be the seventh. You know, you only call them up for the last aliyah on the list. You know, only Leminyan Shiva, you know, you would probably want to translate not as to the count of seven, but to the seven. For the last aliyah, that's what you can count for, but the rest you cannot.
Is the bracha at the end and the beginning?
No, nothing to do with the brachas. The Arizal says, because it's ketana b'ma'ala mikulam. Right? You know, maybe it wouldn't be as mechobad for a katan to get chamishi and then two gedolim to get shishi shvi. You put a katan at the end, we know a katan's a, you know, pun intended, a more minor member of the community, and you give them the most minor, least significant aliyah. There's probably more Kabbalistic things going on behind the scenes. I'm not a proficient Kabbalist, so I'm not going to be very helpful there, unfortunately. So that's in terms of our practice. We really don't call Katanim. Sephardim, maybe a little bit more permissively, Ashkenazim, except for Maftir, we really don't. There's one more question that comes up, and you saw the Mishnah Berurah in Source 17, so we're not going to rehash all of the questions. Like, let's say the only Katan and the only Kohen in the name is a Katan, can you call up the Katan then? So the Mishnah Berurah quotes a debate about this, but he possibly really shouldn't. But the one more din the Mishnah Berurah quotes from the Magen Avraham is that a Katan should not be the Baal Kohen. Right, so all we've been saying until now is about getting an aliyah. But the Magen Avraham said, you should not make a katan a bal kore, you know, no matter what. Meaning, even according to the more permissive views about getting aliyahs, you don't want it to be a bal kore. Which is interesting and not entirely clear why that should be. Meaning, if they could read from the Torah and they could get an aliyah at the time when getting an aliyah meant you were going to read from the Torah, because there wasn't a restriction about bal kore at the time. So it's very hard to understand this. The Lebushe Strad, the commentary on the Magen Avraham, he tries to say, no, a Chatan was only ever allowed to get an Aliyah when someone else was reading for him, but not to read for himself. But hard to imagine. The time of the Gemara, you didn't have an institution of the Baal Koreh. That's not such a simple explanation. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a really interesting tshuva, and we'll end with this, Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked, let's say a bar mitzvah boy learned the wrong parsha by accident. Right? They did the math, they tried to figure out what his bar mitzvah was, and they were off by a week. So the kid prepared, you know, let's imagine, he prepares, you know, Vayakha Pekudei, and it's hard double parsha, turns out he's not bar mitzvah until Vayakra. So can he read the parsha anyway? Do we allow a katan to do that? So that leads Rav Moshe to figure out, can a katan be a Baal Koreh in general? And he notes this Magen Avraham, he's very troubled by it, and he tries to offer an explanation for why a katan can't be a Baal Koreh, because the way that Baal Koreh works is through a mechanism called shlichus, that he's the representative of the person getting an aliyah, and a katan can't be a representative of anyone else in a legal way, so he really can't be a Baal Koreh for the people getting aliyahs, and therefore a katan is, you know, categorically excluded, and Rav Moshe is very convinced of this, and he says, therefore, really, you should not allow a katan to read, to be a Baal Koreh for the Torah. So if you learn the wrong parsha, it's very unfortunate for him. Lachin, in the last line, Ach, Bishad Tzchak in Lahakel, you really shouldn't allow it, because the Magen Avraham is very clear about this. My analysis of the Magen Avraham is very compelling. You have to go back and look through the analysis. But then he says, okay, so there are some Achronim who are lenient, and if it would be a huge tzar gadol to the bar mitzvah boy, then, you know, and the rabbi of the shul wants to be lenient like the other Achronim, so you really shouldn't object, right? Which is a nice example of just sort of rabbinic humility. You have an interpretation, you think it's absolutely the correct interpretation, it's exactly the way to explain this halakha that a katan can't be a Baal Koreh. And it's great, okay, it's great, but there are other Achronim who disagree with me, and I'm not going to cause a kid a bunch of tzar by preventing it from laning. He worked so hard to prepare with a hard double parsha, we're going to have to let him lane. So just an interesting kind of psak that might emerge from the sugya. So just to recap what we saw the statement of the Gemara that a katan is eligible to count towards the seven aliyahs of Shabbos, able to get an aliyah. Some Rishonim took that to be a universal principle, that he get any aliyah. Others limited it in some ways. You need at least one gadol, you need three gadolim. We offered explanations for each of those views. Maybe the reason you're allowed to, and I'll, you know, skipping a few of the reasons now, but maybe the reason you're allowed to have a katan in any aliyah is because it's not really about being motzi anybody in any kind of obligation. It's really just about projecting and teaching Torah publicly, and so it shouldn't really matter if he's a katan or not. Maybe the reason that the other Rishonim offer limitations is because they think you really do need to be motzi, but that only refers to part of the obligation of kriyas the Torah. One of the aliyahs, the Fulta Kach Moshe, or the baseline three aliyahs that you do any day of kriyas the Torah, but the extras that are a function of Shabbos Kriyot, but we don't really need to. It's a possibility for those Rishonim. And then Halacha L'maisa, we talked about the common Ashkenazi practice not to give a katan any aliyah, even though seemingly Me'ikar Din should be able to, based on the Magen Avraham and a few other sources. Should they not to? So we have the custom not to. Svarim tend to be much more lenient about it. When it comes to being a Baal Koreh, so the Magen Avraham says not to. Moshe Feinstein's pretty confident in that fact. And so he really says not to, but maybe of Amalismo, because there's no other way to do Kriyas Torah. Hopefully we try to avoid situations where that should be a leniency that we should need to rely on. Okay, Yishar Kochem, thank you very much.
Thank you, Yeshur Kof.